Mrs. Harrison, reel 4. Did you actually get to France in the end?
Yes, in July 1942, one knew that the deportations, the mass deportations of Jews, they had already started in Holland and in France, and it was a question of time, and they would very soon start. And I seem to remember that I heard that they would start in Belgium after the Belgian national holiday, which is the 21st of July, the Belgian Independence Day, so the equivalent of the 14th of July in France, is the 21st of July in Belgium. And somehow one had heard the rumor that the mass arrests of Jews would start on the 22nd of July. And my father had made preparations. We all had, my mother had sewn some sort of pockets, which what could hang around one's neck, which were lined waterproof material, sort of plastic, one would call it nowadays, in which one could carry one's papers and a certain amount of money if one got separated. And my father made arrangements. I don't know how. We went by train. He bought false identity cards, obviously not Jewish ones, green Belgian identity cards, which was the Belgian card. It was the first time I'd ever had a green card. And my mother's maiden name was changed because my mother's maiden name was Hirsch, and that was changed to Hirsy, which made it sound more, you know, less German, certainly not Jewish. My father, my mother had actually been born in Switzerland, in Basel, so that her accent was, you know, this was a reason for her accent. My father's birthplace was changed to the area of Eupen-Malmedy, which was the part of Belgium which was German and which had been given to Belgium at the end of World War I, which in the meantime, of course, had been re-annexed by Germany. But that explained his accent, because the people who come from that area also have a German accent. That was the only change. The birth dates were the same. My name had remained entirely the same. And my brother, too. And so one didn't have to remember anything. My mother had to remember this new maiden name of hers. My father, the birthdays were the same. My father had to remember that he was born in, I don't know, at Eupen or wherever. And that was all one had to remember if one was questioned. It took us quite a long time to get. We left Brussels on the 20th of July, went to Paris, where I had an uncle and aunt. My uncle was Gentile, my aunt was Jewish. She was my mother's sister. She was arrested on the 14th of July, 1944. She was exactly 1 month before the liberation of Paris. She was on the train to Auschwitz. It was called the children's train, the last train from France to get through to Auschwitz. And she was gassed because she was pregnant. When she couldn't hide it any longer on this morning parade of naked women, she was gassed. Well, that's jumping in. Anyhow, she was, they were in Paris, and we stayed with them. And the next thing was to cross the demarcation line. And there was a lot of trouble. We went three times to the demarcation line, three times came back again. Once to Blois, once to Nevers, which are all on the Loire River, and finally to Bourges. And each time, it's a long story, it didn't work. And at one stage, my father contacted one of these passeurs who, for a great amount of money, would pass people. And it was a doctor. And there was something about it my father didn't like. I don't know what it was. It didn't occur to anybody until long after the war in 1946 or 47. There was this huge big trial of a Dr. Petiot. I don't know if you've ever heard of Dr. Petiot.
No.
He murdered people and incinerated them, or did this, killed them in a bath and had this in lime and stuff, and dozens of people disappeared. And he was condemned to death and guillotined in the late 40s or early 50s. And his trial became, he acted like a film star. He wrote a book. He was signing his book at the trial. And little man, that was the man my father was sent to, whom he didn't trust and we didn't go to. It's incredible. Of course, we didn't know that at the time. We finally got to France, to the unoccupied zone, by taking a train, a goods train, from La Garde, escapes me now, a goods train station in Paris, where trains were going to the south of France, empty trains bringing back fruit and stuff. This was, you know, early summer, July, beginning of August. And my father had paid somewhere. I mean, I don't know the details of this. And we were made to change into railway workers' clothes, and sort of baggy denims and things. And my mother had long hair. I had to stuff it all into her thing. And I think we children, one was aware of it, but it was still a certain amount of fun. I remember bursting out laughing when I saw my mother dressed in these things in the middle of the night at this railway station in Paris. And then we had to go underneath some trains, just the four of us. And we went into this red painted wagon. All these wagons said 40 men, 8 horses, count on we chevaux. For years, I could never see one of these count on we chevaux because we ended up spending 4 days and 4 nights in this blessed thing without thinking of this. They don't exist anymore now. And they were wood and they were painted sort of brick red on the outside. And we sat in this train for about 2 or 3 hours, and it was full of empty peach cases, because, of course, there was a shortage of wood and everything else. So when the peaches from the south of France were delivered to the north of France, the empties had to be returned. And they had been sort of thrown into this carriage, and there was hardly any room for us. And so one had to wait. And when the train moved, we started tidying the place up and making a room, a little corner for ourselves, and piled it all up. Anyhow, it took us, I don't remember, 2 or 3 days or 4 days. And my father had a railway guide with him. One couldn't look out. One could only look out when the train was moving by standing next to these openings. And I think my father must have seen places we passed on a number of occasions. We had an idea where we were going. We didn't know when we were on the demarcation line because the Germans had sold us with dogs. And how they didn't smell us out, I don't know. I remember sitting there, facing my mother, you know, almost nose to nose. And my mother, her eyes got, she had always very large eyes, my mother. They got larger and larger. My mother was absolutely petrified. We all were, but with her, it really did show. No, they didn't. The train moved on after, 6 hours, 10 hours. And of course, every time the train stopped, one could not move. One could only move and make a noise and, you know, when the train was moving. And on one occasion, the train moved after hours. And, of course, if the train moved, you thought you were actually going somewhere. But it was in a railway siding. It was being shunted. You didn't know that. And suddenly, of course, it hit another carriage. Apart from the fact that it was a shock you had when it hit this carriage, all these peach cases, which my brother and I had carefully loaded up to the ceiling, all collapsed on top of us. And, of course, the train stopped. And we were all four sitting there with these not heavy cases and, you know, these flat boxes, you know, on top of us. And we sat there for a long time, and my brother and I were whispering, and I said, look, this is ridiculous. He said, don't you know that sometimes something falls, which has been just on the edge of something, and if we count up to 3 and then just do this, nobody will come and look. You know? My father said, don't you dare do that. But of course, one couldn't stop us, you know. And we said, well, look, just logically thinking, this can happen. Nobody, if it is just one big noise, followed by dead silence afterwards, because we couldn't sit there much longer. And we did it, and nothing happened. My mother almost died of fright. Anyhow, we got to a place 20 kilometers south of Lyon called Givors, G-I-V-O-R-S, on a railway, a goods railway station, a big gare de triage called Grigny. We didn't know that at the time, of course, G-R-I-G-N-Y. And we must have stood there for 12 hours. We had nothing to eat. We had nothing to drink. It was absolutely desperate. We had been told the train was going to Marseille. We were another 6 or 7 or 8 hours if the train was actually moving from Marseille, if not longer. And this was it. I mean, we were in the free zone, and about midnight, my brother said he's going to go out and have a look. And again, my father said, well, my father, one couldn't object, because you could not stop anybody doing something. Paternal authority, what do you do in a case like that? You couldn't have a row in a railway carriage, could you, when you were hiding? So at midnight, my brother opened the door, because the doors weren't locked, because, you know, there was just empty cases supposed to be in there, and disappeared, and was gone for quite a long time. Seemed long, seemed very long. And, of course, all the railway workers in France belonged to the Communist Party and were in the resistance, etc. And were very, very helpful. My brother came back with a couple of these chaps. They gave us a French habitaiment stamps, Russian stamps, so that we could at least walk out, and told us where to go. And we got out, walked down the road, arrived at this little hotel in this place called Givaud, and there are again little things one does not think of. We arrived there, we booked in, we were given two rooms, and they said, oh, said, which train did you come on? How, you know, I mean, at that time there was no train stopping there. I have no idea what my father answered, how he got out of that one. Anyway, then we lived there. This was the 5th of August, 1942. Now, because we had tried to reach the demarcation line on three previous occasions without success, my father had left the bulk of his money with a friend of my uncle's, whom we hadn't known until we got to Paris in July, with the idea that he would send it on to us as soon as he got a message, some sort of cryptic coded message, and he would then send this money on to us, when then we would go to the Swiss border and cross. And this man, I wouldn't call him a crook, I don't remember his name, had his own business and was in some sort of difficulty at the time, or needed a short-term loan on something. And when we departed, I don't know how much money it was, it must have been quite a lot, he used this money, all this we found out only long afterwards, he used this money to get himself out of trouble. He wasn't in a way defrauding us, except that when we were getting ready, when we were ready for him to send us the money, he didn't have it. And it took months, and it was terribly worrying, of course. We only had the clothes we stood up in. It must have been hell for my father. And by the time we got the money, which was about 3-4 months later, the Americans, the Allied had landed in North Africa, the Germans had occupied the rest of France, which meant that the Germans were on the Swiss border. And my father, probably because of my mother, well, people were middle-aged, they didn't risk that as a family, you know, and one knows nowadays people were crossing the Pyrenees and into Switzerland, but as a family, and it was quite a different proposition. And we didn't have people to make us walk, and my mother couldn't have walked into to Switzerland, I don't think. Anyway, we were stuck there. My brother decided that it was safer for him to return to Brussels, and he again talked to the railway workers and returned on a railway engine. He crossed on the actual engine, he crossed the demarcation line, went back to Brussels, went underground, was with the resistance in Belgium for 2 years, ended up in jail, but somehow got away with it. And that left us my father, my mother and me. And there again, one had made certain contacts. Of course, people there thought we were Belgians. Nobody knew. There we were not Jews, we were Belgians. Why we'd come down? Well, we'd come to unoccupied France. You see, we'd left occupied territory. There were no questions asked. They must have asked themselves a lot of questions about us, because we certainly didn't fit in there. The first night we'd spent in this place, the idea was that we would go to Lyon. The very next day, my father, we all went to Lyon the next day, I think, on a proper passenger train. And my father had some sort of contact there. I don't know who my father knew in Lyon. Anyhow, he contacted somebody. He said, look, things are very bad here in Lyon. This was unoccupied at the time. You're far better off in a small little place. Go back where you spent the night last night. Don't come and try and live in Lyon. And that is how we spent 2 years in this little place called Givaud, which we'd never even heard of before. We actually got stuck there. We had to have an address because we were waiting for the money from Paris, which didn't arrive. And the idea was that we would stay there in that hotel until the money arrived. Anyhow, when the Germans occupied the rest of France, they came to this little town. I call it a village. It had 18,000 inhabitants. It was a little industrial town. And occupied the hotel. Everybody, the hotel wasn't exactly full of people, but we had two permanent rooms there. No, one. I was sleeping with my parents with three beds in the room. After my brother had gone, I think. I forget where my brother slept. And there was this hotel with us staying in it. Every room was occupied by a German officer. And I remember my father one day going downstairs and sort of furtively. By that time we knew the owners quite well, who did not know who we were, really. Sorry. My father looked through the register. They'd all registered on the proper hotel register, because he was afraid that he might know some names or somebody who might remember him. If it was somebody from the Rhineland, you could never tell. And, of course, we had to get out of there because they wanted the room, but we had to, they were decent, so these people have to find accommodation elsewhere because we need the room. And we then found accommodation in a furnished flat of a woman who was very much an opportunist. Many French people were opportunists at the time. They were not anti-German, they were not anti-British, they were sitting on the fence. The young ones and the old ones were... their heart was in the resistance from the beginning. The ones who'd been too young in 1418 and too old in 1939 to be mobilized, there were the fence sitters. One thing I would like to record here. When I was in Brussels one day, I was on a tram, and a German officer was sitting down, and a woman got on, and the German got up and offered her his place, and she said, "No, thank you." Whereupon everybody smiled. The German did not sit down again. The seat remained empty. It was another one of these marvelous showings of which way the land lay. When I was in France 2 years later, exactly the same thing happened. A German came in. A woman came in. A German offered his seat. The woman said, "Thank you very much," and sat down. And after the German had got off, another passenger said to this woman, "You're on good terms with the Germans, with the Bosch, whatever," openly. And the French woman replied, "Not at all." He said, "Why should I stand up while he sits down?" And to me, this has always represented the difference between the Belgians and the French. They were both against the German. The French is more practical, more of an opportunist. The women had the right reaction, and yet that was the difference to me. But between Belgium and France, on the whole, it's perhaps simplifies. It sounds a bit simplistic, perhaps, but it does explain a lot. I feel I've always come back to that little story.
So you were talking about this lady who was an opportunist.
Well, she was. Yes, she was an old lady. She had a son who was a notaire, and he was pro-Vichy. You see, the French they were so shattered by what had happened. That they rallied around Pétain, which is very understandable. You know, by rallying around Pétain, that didn't make you into a collaborator, not in the beginning, anyway. And it's really very understandable. I mean, the way people would have rallied here around a First War British general. The le vainqueur de Verdun. You know, the man who won Verdun for them. I mean, it is understandable. It is acceptable. At the beginning. But then the sort of the little resistance bit started there, which, just to cheer people up, for instance, I used to go to Lyon. I decided, I got in touch with some people and again wanted to do some courier work, and I said, right, I started learning Italian when I was in Belgium. So I went to Lyon and I went to the Italian fascist consulate and said that I was looking for an Italian teacher. And there was a woman there, fascist, said her sister was not very well and she'd love to give Italian lessons. And I went to this Italian woman, recommended to me by the fascist consulate, and I had an Italian lesson once a week, which gave me a marvelous reason for traveling from Givor to Lyon once a week on a bus with either messages or all sorts of odd things. And I did a courier work there. I had one contact in Lyon and I had one or two contacts in Givor, which is really, in a way, all I did. Just this courier work. but it was a good cover. And except that because I was a foreigner, I was, they believed I was a Belgian. If I wanted to go to Lyon, I had to have a permit, and I had to go once a week. I had to go to the Hotel de Ville to get a travel permit. And I used to get fed up with this because by that time I knew everybody. It was a small town. I knew the police commissaire and the police de whatever they called it, la gendarmerie. And one day I went to Lyon and I had not obtained this travel permit. And the bus was very crowded, and the commissaire de gendarmerie, wasn't called a commissaire anymore, the head of the gendarmerie, was on the same bus. And the bus was stopped by the Germans just for checking papers, just outside Lyon. And I was really worried. And he looked at me, and he realized I hadn't been the day before. He knew I didn't have a permit. So he edged his way towards me. And when the Germans came to asking our papers, he produced his papers first, which was head of the gendarmerie. And then he said, this lady's traveling with me. And that was it. So he did. So that helped. I mean, I don't know what would have happened, perhaps nothing much. Except what he didn't know is that I was carrying things on that particular occasion. And you see, Lyon was very short of green vegetables and things, and in Givors it was really the country, and I always brought peas and beans and stuff, and potatoes to my Italian teacher, and I carried them on top of my little shopping bag. And so it was easy. Then at the end, so in a way, life was normal day. It was boring. Then the parachute deliveries of goods and things started. And I knew them. There was a message for the area in which I was working, which was, one always listened to the BBC with these famous messages that came over. And ours was, le renard mange du raisin. The fox eats grapes. And if one heard that, one knew that if something was going to happen on that particular night. I never went through a dropping zone. I never knew exactly where the dropping zone was. But afterwards, several days afterwards, often when the stuff was being disposed of, then I was given things to carry away and to take to odd place, which I knew came from there, could only have come from there. I also carried false identity cards sometimes, blank ones, from one place to another, that kind of thing. And I found out only very, very recently that some of these cards that I had carried were for British airmen, and which is very strange, seeing that now I'm secretary of the RAF Escaping Society. It's all linked up. I didn't know the name of the organization. It was Mouvement Uni de la Résistance, which is MUR. But I didn't know that. But there wasn't a name. I mean, all these, when you hear these names of these lines now, there weren't any names, not known to most of the people anyway. Then, but after the landings on the 15th of course, then the landings in Normandy, one knew it was, you know, definitely coming to an end. It was just a question of time, and there were more and more people in the resistance, and then also, the Maquis started being formed, several in the area. And they really started when the Germans started recruiting young men to go to Germany to work in the factories, and they wouldn't go, and they then retired into the Maquis, and the young men sort of disappeared off the streets. And there was a girl there called Suzanne, a dreadful girl, was a waitress in a pub there. And one of the jobs I was told to do is to become more friendly with her than I was on the surface. She was my age, so I wouldn't talk to one another. And she was sleeping around, and she was sleeping around with middle-aged men who were paying her better money than young men. Anyhow, they were no more. The young men had really, in a way, disappeared. And she was finding out where the sons of these men were and giving them away, sleeping with these men and denouncing sons. And I was told to find out who she was sleeping with. It was as simple as that. And I did. I became very friendly with Suzanne and found out a lot of things like that. Then there was another girl whose parents were not collaborators, but fence-sitters, and she was a dreadful girl, also of my age. I became friendly with her, and her parents owned a shoe shop, and the Maquis were short of shoes, and they had quite a stock of bots and, you know, ordinary walking shoes, men's shoes. So I became very friendly with her to get to know a little bit where the shoes were kept. And I went to the shoe shop very often, and I had tea with her, and we played cards together. And I gave this information, fine art, and in that way I took part in the one night this shoe shop was robbed, and it was the next morning only women's shoes in the entire shop.
What happened to this Suzanne?
Suzanne, I had the fright of my life. When we were before the liberation, may I come back to Suzanne at the end?
Yes.
Because it's something that happened to Suzanne. On the 24th of August, 1944, we were bombed by the Americans. The resistance had undertaken to mine a road that was leading. The Germans were leaving by then, and the roads were full of Germans retreating. And there was a road which had to be blown to blown up in order to stop them. It's very rocky around there. It's all along the Rhone. One side of the Rhone River is the Département de l'Isère, and the other one is the Département du Rhône. And the Allies were walking up, the Americans were walking up one side of the Rhone, and the French the other, and the Germans in front of them, very much so. And also the funny vehicles. The German women, I'll never forget this. They'd taken branches of trees and camouflaged themselves the way they usually do. You know? But the women, this was August 1944, the German women had taken off their uniforms. They were in bathing costumes and in their bras and their pants. They were sunbathing on these things going north when they were retreating. Very strange sight.
On which things going north?
On the lorries, anything they requisitioned, anything, because they were running away. With the women sunbathing on the roofs of the things, it's very strange. I mean, not all of them, but I mean, we all saw it, and not just on one day. Anyhow, on the 24th of August, the resistance, I don't know, the road hadn't been bombed, and the Americans came, and they always said it was a mistake. Instead of bombing the road, they could perfectly have well bombed it and stopped the traffic going up. They bombed Givor. They destroyed the whole central street. We had a lot of people killed there. And all my contacts were gone. I didn't know who to contact. So I went to a nearest hospital, which was really an old age home, called Montgelas, Montgelas, on the road to Lyon, about 2 or 3 miles out of Givors, and where I had one more contact, a young doctor from Lyon, whose name I forget. I was stuck in that hospital from the 24th of August until the liberation on the 3rd of September. Lyon was liberated on the 3rd of September, so was Brussels, incidentally, but of course I didn't know that at the time. And it was pretty hair-raising in the hospital. By that time we had German people who were injured as well, you know, German soldiers injured, and we had a lot of resistance people. And it was a large old age home with wings to it, and we had one wing reserved for the Germans and one for the resistance. Otherwise, we would have, you know, people were so. I mean, people would have got out of bed and started shooting at each other. Maybe not the Germans at the resistance, but the resistance would have gone to murder people in their beds there. And on one day, two German officers came up, and one had his arm in a sling, and he had a stray bullet which had gone in his shoulder. He had a little wound here, just under the skin. And you could see it was a razor, like a boil, really, like a pimple. It was in the middle of his spine, but, I mean, not a dangerous thing. It was just a question of cutting it out. But it had traveled from his arm, from his shoulder to the back of his neck, high up, you know, on his shoulder. And we had decided to ask every German who came in there wounded, did he want to be fixed up and to continue retreating, or did he want us to fix him up in such a way, put him in plaster or put him out and keep him there, so that he would be taken prisoner, that it was over for him, the war was over. And many of them had opted for that, as long as we promised them that they would be made prisoners by the Americans, not by the French, because they were coming, as I say, one army on each side of the river. We promised anything. I mean, we didn't care. Who were we to promise? You know, the first ones who came, because the French obviously treated their prisoners far worse than the Americans did. Now, these two Germans came up, very nasty types, and they said, we have a column waiting for us downstairs on the road.